Okay, everyone, good evening, and welcome to the fourth in our series, The Wise Son, the ladies of the London S&P Sephardi community. Tonight we are looking at perhaps the, the least successful of all of our, writers, in a sense, certainly not well known, but I think my favorite out of all of the people that I've been studying. I absolutely love her publication, which we're going to look at, which are called Sabbath Evenings at Home. And we'll be looking at this publication, which she did in 1856. And this, of course, is part of our series looking at different things, different publications that were produced by women in the community, hence they are known as the Wise Son, because they are certainly seem to be publishing far more than men are within the community of a scholarly nature. And this particular text, I would say, is the most Jewish of all of the texts that we are looking at. We've looked at novels, we've looked at dictionaries. This one really gets into the substance of Judaism and Jewish thought. I'm really enjoying reading it. I've read nearly half of it, so I can't say that I'm an expert on the entire work, but I hope at least enough to be able to kind of communicate with to you a bit about what this work is about and why it's and why it is important, and to kind of be able to place it within this grouping of writings that we've been looking at, and to actually kind of see how it fits into the things that we've been talking about during this series, and seeing how so many of these writings, including this one, are in a sense a response or are inspired by the things that are taking place within the Jewish world in London at this time. Right, and so whether those are issues related to conversion tactics of missionaries, whether it has to do with emancipation, whether it has to do with reform movement, and so on, then we'll see how she fits into this broader theme, and to this theme, which really is about education, right? Which is about trying to create materials that can be used to educate the next generation and to enable the community to continue, right? And to be able to maintain itself and not to become increasingly not only acculturated, but assimilated or disenfranchised from kind of the community. And by the community, I mean the Bismarck Synagogue, right? Essentially, right? The Sephardic community that had been here since the 1600s. And so we're going to look at this. And one of the things I want to focus on a little bit is to see to what extent Miriam's story is similar to the stories of the other ladies that we are looking at. Obviously, they're all different people, and they have different stories, but there seem to be certain similarities to their stories. Okay, and so let's just take a quick look over here at this at source number one, which is a Dictionary of Anglo-Jewish History, where it identifies Miriam Mendes Belisario. So let's read what it says here. It says that Isaac Mendes Belisario, scholar and preacher, and Miriam Mendes Belisario, teacher and author. Isaac was Ruby, was the teacher at the Bevis Marks Congregation School, right? He was one of the educators in the synagogue school in the 18th century, and it but he seemed to have also been considered to be a scholar of sorts and a respected figure in the community, because he often, or at times, even gave public addresses to the adults in the community as well. An address he gave in 1760 on the passing of George II is extant in translation from the Spanish as a sermon occasioned by the death of his late majesty. He wrote in 1760, so he wrote, he actually, I think, did two different speeches, that's one of them. With her sisters, Rose and Caroline, his granddaughter Miriam ran a well-patronized Jewish girls' school in Hackney, founded in 1807 by their mother, Esther Mendes Belisario, née Lindo. Miriam published Hebrew and English vocabulary, right? So she wrote another kind of dictionary in 1848. It was a guide for prayer, intended as an aid for prayer. And the book we're going to look at tonight, Sabbath Evenings at Home, in 1856, with revisions by the Reverend David Aaron DeSola, the Chazan of the community, which takes the form of dialogues upon the spirit and practice of Judaism. Like her cousin Lydia Belisario, she was a friend of and influence upon the Philo-Semitic Christian writer Charlotte Elizabeth Tona. The birth date, 1820, often given for Miriam, belongs to her brother Jacob. Okay, fine. So here we have a kind of a short description of who she was, and I want to talk a little bit about it because there are interesting things that are often said about her that I want to take a look at. Let me see. This is not, well, not in the next verse. So if you look in Chaimson, who's kind of the main author of this, called his book called the Albert Chaimson, the Sephardim of England. He looks at the Spanish Portuguese community. It's from the, I believe, the 1950s. And so he talks about it, and he identifies that Miriam was not alone as the only kind of successful person in the family, because she also had a successful brother, right? And so you have Miriam, right, who is going to be a descendant, right, going up two steps, right, make a better tree later, right, of this Isaac Mendez, right? So that's her great-grandfather, right? But then she also, right, there's her, and there is her brother, also by the name of Isaac Mendez Belisario. Now, he may be familiar to you as the artist who drew this print. Right, so this famous print of the community showing the interior of Bevis Marks. This was it was originally a watercolor. The watercolor hangs at Lauderdale Road Synagogue. This is a print that they made afterwards, in obviously it's black and white, showing the interior. And this was made in 1812. Okay, that's the date that is presumed for it. It's the first piece that he did. He went on to have a career in Jamaica as an artist, where he printed or he painted or drew watercolors of many of the African people, the slaves, right, on the island, showing the way that they would celebrate some of the festivals and the different clothing that they would wear. He's kind of considered to be almost kind of like the national artist of Jamaica. He makes some really beautiful paintings. Maybe I can even miss him here. Let's see if we can do this. Oh no, internet connected. Right, so you can see some really beautiful kinds of paintings that that he made, showing the people there. And so he's a very important painter in Jamaica. And where, of course, there was a sizable Jewish community. One of the most famous paintings he did, for our purposes, besides for the one of Bevis Marks, is this one. This one's off of my blog. This was perhaps the last painting that he did in the 1830s, was of the rabbi, the Chazan, in Jamaica, which is a great showing of the way they wore the talet at that time. So he was an important figure in that regard. Both he did some important Jewish works, as well as important works for the place that he called home in Jamaica. So that's the general story of her. Now, what I wanted to just look at is one of the things that we've noticed or kind of come across. We've mentioned a few different people within our series. Obviously, we're going to be talking about Miriam tonight, but we've spoken about Grace Aguilar. Grace Aguilar is not dissimilar in that she also has a brother. Does anybody know her brother's name? She has a brother, David. David is important for the history of the community as well, because he was the one who essentially authored the first publication of the music of the synagogue, also did it in conjunction with De Sola, and it was the first time that the music was actually written down in notation form. It also has an introduction about the history of Jewish music and so on, but then actually goes in, and so kind of it's one of the early records from, I think it's the 1850s, of actually showing what our music sounded like at the very least in the 1850s. And so he was an accomplished musician and was able to kind of do that with the chazan of the synagogue. And so you find, you know, here you have one family with sibling, another one, even Abigail Lindo, we mentioned that her father had been a scholar. And so it seems, and this is where you kind of start putting these stories together, where it seems that, at least what I found among historians when they talk about, you know, the Spanish and Portuguese Jews, they talk about these merchant families, kind of, you know, the wealthy families within the community and kind of their connections and so on. And you'll also find, obviously, discussions about the maybe the rabbis of the community. But what you don't actually find is that there is this kind of class of families within the community that are the scholars, right? That are kind of the educated ones within the community, maybe the more religious ones, we could say, within the community, right? The ones who aren't wealthy merchants, but are probably, in many ways, the bedrock of the community, right? The people who are really actively participating and educating and making sure to educate their daughters as well, right? Those are things that are really important to them, and so that's what they're seeing in their homes, right? Their fathers are studying, their brothers are studying, they're studying, right? And so there's also that whole part of the community. I actually haven't seen much written about that. That's kind of my area of interest for my PhD work, is to kind of look at that whole part of the community that really is just beginning to kind of present itself to me through these lectures that we're having, where we're seeing all of these kind of families, the Osarios, the Aguilars, the Lindos, right? And it's not surprising, as some of you have pointed out to me, right, that you even so often will see marriages between these families. There's, right, we mentioned that that Miriam's mother, Esther, she's a Lindo, right? And so you start seeing that actually there are a number of these people within the story. Now, what exactly is the story? Who is this Esther that's kind of in the middle over here, or this Esther Lindo, right, who we say is the one who opens up this school that we saw in that source? So Esther is from Jamaica. Okay, Esther is from Jamaica, and the story is that Abraham Mendez Belisario, right? So Abraham is the son of this Isaac. He goes to Jamaica, right? Isaac Mendez Belisario is one of the rabbis in the community in London. His son Abraham goes to Jamaica. There's a large Spanish Portuguese community there as well. It's obviously part of the British Empire. He goes over to Jamaica and he works for Alexander Lindo. Okay, so there's this other fellow, Alexander Lindo. And he has a daughter, Esther, and they end up getting married, right? And they have Miriam, and also named after his father, Isaac Mendez Belisario. Okay? And then at a certain point, it seems that they have major financial troubles. Alexander has major financial problems, and therefore they become bankrupt. They owe money. They have to leave. They have to flee. They flee to London, right? So the whole family needs to relocate to London in the early 1800s. I think the date that I saw is 1803. Right, 1803. Right, and according to what we saw, it says that Miriam is born in 1816. Isaac Mendez is born much earlier, right? He's already alive by the time they go. According to records, he was already born in
I think it's 1794, if I'm correct. I think he was 9 years old when they left. Okay, so obviously quite a bit older than his sister Mary. Okay, and so that's kind of the story of this family. They're on both sides of the Atlantic. They're rabbis, they're merchants, they're scholars, right? It's a really kind of interesting story. At a certain point, Abraham will leave. He's going to go back to try and make money in other ways. It could be that's why Esther opens up a school. Maybe she has to support the family. And she starts a school that Miriam will then work in as well, right? With her, what does it say, with her three other sisters, right? With the four girls, right? So there's obviously other girls in the family. And that's what we can see back over here, right? As it says that, right, his granddaughter Miriam ran a well-positioned school, patronized Jewish school in Hackney, founded in 1807 by their mother, Esther Mendes Belisario, and did it with her sisters, Rose and Caroline. Okay, so there you have the basic kind of story. It makes sense. We kind of get what's going on within this. But let me go forward with you. Because this was a lot of fun for me, kind of looking into this, when I started to see that there seemed to be some something not adding up with this story, okay? And so this is going to be part of our lecture tonight is what actually happened. So you'll be kind of joining me on some of the research I've been doing. So this is an article that was written in 1987, The Jews of Hackney Before 1840. And it says here the following. It says, among the more notable inhabitants of the parish, Grace Aguilar was born here in 1816 to a family which on her mother's side had links to the district going back to the 1740s. The Aguilars moved away in 1824 and returned some years later when they fixed on the triangle as a house large enough to accommodate the family and a few boarders at the academy Grace Aguilar's mother established, right? So the Aguilars also had an academy, had a small school there as well. And that's interesting as well about what the education facility was in the community. That of course the synagogue had a school, but that was known as the poor school, right? The people who came to the synagogue school tended to be the poor in the community. Those that were wealthier went to these independent schools. So there were people in the community that were not being educated by the community, right? They weren't going to Shari Tikva, right? They weren't going to the synagogue school. That would have been for the less wealthy. The wealthier ones were going to these independent schools, Jewish, and in some cases, like the Israelis, not even Jewish, right? Before they fished up the community, they were going to just other schools that weren't necessarily Jewish. So it wasn't that everyone in the community was going to the community school. There were these independent schools. So the Aguilars had one. And then, as we see, Grace also mentions that there were other schools. In a short story entitled Red Rose Villa and Its Inhabitants, included in the posthumous Home Scenes and Heart Studies that Grace had written, Grace described a first-rate finishing school for young ladies of the first families, right? A school that was where the wealthiest people in the community sent their children, with its own family, like hers, of two sisters and two brothers. This may have been a sly glance at another Jewish school nearby, the Academy for Young Ladies at 5 Wickham Place, Clapton, kept by Lydia, Miriam, Rose, and Caroline, the four daughters of Abraham Belisario, the Jamaica merchant. Miriam Belisario herself was to achieve a measure of literary celebrity with the publication of 1856 of her Sabbath Evenings at Home. Okay, cool, we have this other corroborating evidence, but there's a contradiction in this very paragraph, because what it describes or what it has Grace is saying is she says there was another school like hers of two sisters and two brothers. Now, it then goes on to say that she was doing it with her sisters, Lydia, Miriam, Rose, Caroline. And so is it similar in that it was four children? I thought it said two sisters and two brothers is what Grace had, and then you expect that would maybe be the same with the Belisarios. Not to mention that who does it list as one of the people she's doing it with? Lydia. Well, I thought Lydia's her cousin. Now, you could have within cousins the same names as well, which is possible, so maybe Lydia is both you know, in both sides of the family, right, through some other, right, child, right, meaning the presumption is that there's a cousin, right, that also Isaac Mendes had some other son who had children, right, and that maybe he had a Lydia as well. So maybe there's a Lydia in both families. It's all a bit convoluted. It's not entirely clear what exactly is going on with these families. So let's go on and look at another source. This is source number 3, okay? Where it said, this is from Journal Jewish History, an article written by Todd Endelman, who is really the preeminent historian today on Anglo-Jewry. So this is in a footnote in this article about assimilation within Anglo-Jewry. That's one of, actually the title of one of his, of a book that he publishes as well, where he says the following. He says, the school, he's talking about, we'll look at this in a bit. There's a journal that was kept by this Eliza Aria. So she writes that she had gone to school as a girl. She was born in the 1860s, okay? And so she describes the school. She goes, and so he's talking about, he goes, the school, which attracted children from the Sephardi community in particular, was kept by the 4 daughters of Abraham Belisario, a Jamaica merchant. One of the sisters, Miriam Mendez Belisario, compiled the Hebrew and English vocabulary for the daily prayers and wrote Sabbath Evenings at Home, a collection of dialogues on Judaism. And he quotes the Jews of Hackney before 1840, right? So he's basing his information here about these 4 sisters, the daughters of Abraham Belisario, on this article that he came across from 1987, right? About, right, he's writing this article in 1994. Okay, so he's relying on that earlier piece. But we still have the contradictions about with Lydia, right? Which is it a sister or is it a cousin, right? And the other contradiction of, is it supposed to be 4 daughters or is it supposed to be a family of 2 girls and 2 boys like the Aguilar family? Okay, so let's go on a little further. This is from the Jewish Encyclopedia. So this is from 1906. Okay, so this is an even earlier entry about Mary Mendez Belisario. Right, so it was known to the Jewish Encyclopedia to write about her, even though today people don't really know about her. And it says the following: it says, "Who was she?" And this is written by the head of the London the Anglo-Jewish Historical Society at the time, or the head of the Historic Society. I forget. He's like one of the main people up there. So he writes the following: he goes, "Who was she? English authoress and teacher, born in London about 1820." Right, so that's. That's the mistake that was corrected later, that no, it's actually 1816, fine. Died there 1885. So that we hadn't seen before, right? So she lives till 1885, right? Along a nice life, okay? Now what does it say? She was a granddaughter of Isaac Mendez Belisario, okay? That's what it is. And with her sisters for many years, again with her sisters, kept a girls' school in which numerous members of the Sephardic community were educated under her direction. She compiled Hebrew language vocabulary for a selection of daily prayers and wrote Sabbath evenings at home, the latter being the form of dialogues upon the spirit and ordinances of the Jewish religion. Right, so we can see here in this source, right, this is kind of the original source stating who she was. It doesn't say anything that her mother had started the school. That's not in here, right? That seems to get added in that other source that we had looked at, but it does say that she ran the school with her sisters. Okay? So it still seems that you can kind of trace where this story is coming from of her and her sisters, even though the source we have from her actual time of Aguilar, who lived at the same time, described it as 2 girls and 2 boys. And yet, with all these other sources, it describes she did it with her sisters, because in fact, we know from the historical record that Abraham Mendez did have a whole bunch of girls. Right, and so it makes sense. Okay, it's actually talking about all of these sisters. And in fact, the boy that we know from the family, also named Isaac Mendez, we know wasn't running the school because he was painting. Right, so he obviously wasn't one of the people in the school. We know he goes to Jamaica, so obviously he's not in it. So it must not be 2 girls and 2 boys. It must be this family of girls, the daughters of Abraham. So let's just go on a little bit more to see if we can figure out what actually is happening over here. So let's take a look at this. Says, Sabbath Evenings at Home by Miriam Mendez Belisario, right? And what does it say over here? This is her kind of opening thing. She says, remember, this is in 1856. What does she write? To her sole surviving parent, her beloved mother, whom she fervently prays that may be spared to her for many years. The little work is affectionately inscribed by her dutiful child, the author. Now, we had seen earlier, I'm pretty sure we saw it in an earlier source, Let's see if I wrote it there. If not, I'll share it with you. That what year did her mother die? What does that say? Esther Mendez Belisario? 1824. What year did she publish this book? 1856. So her mother's not Esther Mendez Belisario, because that would mean her mother had been dead for 30 years. She wouldn't be describing her as her sole surviving parent. This is good, right? Okay, so let's see. So what's going on over here, right? Because something doesn't add up. She can't be the daughter of Esther Lindo. She dies in 1824. She's publishing this in 1854, and she's making the title page of the book, you know, to her mother, who she says she prays that she may be spared for many more years. So her mother's obviously alive. So she can't be the daughter of Esther. So what's actually happening in this story? So I found the Bevismark's birth register and looked up the Belisario family. And we can see over here, I'll just kind of point it out so everyone can kind of see what's going on. I'll use the pointer right over here. It says Mendez Belisario, and it shows you the name of the child that's born, and it shows who their parents are. So you have over here from Abraham and Esther in 1800, in 1810, Amelia's born, they have a son Samuel that's born, right? And then you have other, you have an Aaron and Hannah who have a Leia or a Lydia, right? In 1836. And then you have a bunch of these Isaac and Leahs, perhaps, right, an earlier generation, because you can see all of their children, Isaac and Leah's children, probably the original Isaac Mendez Belisario, right, the grandfather, his wife Leah, that they have children in 1771, right, and among their children you can see they have an Abraham, they have a Jacob, they have a Moses, they have a Daniel, they have a Clara, right, so they, all of their children, or sorry, those four, right, Jacob, Moses, Daniel, or David, right, so they have those, and Abraham, right? So they have those four children that are listed there in the 1700s, right? And that's where Isaac, you know, the grandfather comes from, right? That's where all these children come from. The Abraham in our story, right, seems to be the eldest of all of the children, right? And so, and he's the one that goes off to Jamaica to try and make it as a merchant, even though his father is a rabbi in the community, okay? But then over here we have another family, Jacob and Julia, right? Yehudit, perhaps? Judithia, right? Yehudit. And we see that they have four children. Who are their four children? Miriam, Jacob, Elisha, and Oriel, right? Which seem to be two girls and two boys. Here you have Miriam, born what year? 1816. They have a son, Jacob. They have, I think this is a daughter, Elisha, and Oriel, which I think is a boy's name, right? And so, or maybe swapping those two, okay? And so they end up having four children, okay? So now, let's take a little bit of a story over here. So clearly, who was Miriam's parents?
Jacob and
Yehudit, right? This Julia, right? Jacob, right. So those are her actual parents. Her parents are not Esther and Abraham, right? Her parents are from the second son of Jacob, right? The second son of Isaac Mendez Belisario. Okay, so she's actually from, right? And let's take this off because there is no Lydia there, right? She is from, right, Jacob and this Judith, right, or Yehudit, right? Okay, and I believe she is a DaCosta. DaCosta the family, right? And then they have Miriam, right? So this family does not, right? This family does not have the Miriam, but they do have other children, as we'll see.
They didn't even have the Isaac.
What?
They don't even have the Isaac.
He was born in Jamaica.
In Jamaica.
So, right, so meaning they were in Jamaica originally, so probably the a lot of the Jamaica records had been destroyed, but he would be in the Jamaica,
okay,
Spanish-Portuguese records, right, from having been at that time. Okay? Now, who was this Jacob? Who was this Jacob? So, it's a complicated story, but here, this is from a story about the family. It says, then there's Jacob Mendes Belisario. Who was Jacob? He was Isaac's uncle, right? So he's Isaac's uncle, and now things are going to make sense. A London art dealer and stockbroker. So here you have Isaac Mendes comes to London with his family. His father, Abraham, shortly thereafter leaves and goes back to the Caribbean. So who's looking after him? Uncle Jacob. What does Uncle Jacob do? He's an art dealer. Oh, he learns how to paint and then goes on to his career as art, yeah, and he's in the community. I mean, they're in the community. First thing he paints is the synagogue, right? I mean, that's what he sees. That's what's around him until he himself goes back to Jamaica and continues his career there. There's a sad story about this Jacob. He says that in 1822, Jacob Mendes Belisario became involved in the most audacious fraud in history when he became the agent for Gregor MacGregor, a Scottish inventor, who managed to raise some £200,000 on the London market at 6% interest as he beguiled London society and the man in the street alike to invest in Poyais, a new republic on the Caribbean coast of Central America. The only problem was that Poyais didn't exist. The bond issues, land sales, and trumped-up concern of the imaginary terror Poyais were all part of a brilliant scam. So, complicated story. But nonetheless, that seems to be. So now, if we take the story back a little bit further, right? And here we'll take a look at it, right? So when it describes what was going on, and we said that it was, right, this description from Aguilar about two sisters and two brothers, well, that's correct, right? She's referring to this family over here. Now, is it possible that Esther founded the school after her husband left, and then maybe her nieces and nephews are the ones working it? I guess possible. I don't really know where the source that it was founded by Esther comes from. I looked around in some of the other things that are referenced in some of those sources. I didn't find any of them actually talking about that. So that requires a little bit more work of kind of who founded it. Perhaps it makes more sense that the CUD is the one who founded it with her children. I don't know. I have to look more into that. But there are four children here. They seem to run the school together. And they have a daughter whose name is Lydia. Right? So this is so they are right. They're cousins, right? But this is the cousin, right? So this is the cousin Lydia, right? That is also there, who's also kind of becomes famous for talking to, some of these Christian people and so on, right? That was referred to in that earlier source, right? But this is the family that we're talking about, and Isaac Mendes is the cousin, right? So they're not siblings, as Chaim Sin writes. They're actually cousins, right? And they're from two different branches of the family. Okay, but they did live together in London, so you can see where some of the confusion comes from.
Come from the fact that Isaac was raised by his uncle.
No one claims that Isaac's father is Jacob, though.
No,
meaning, no one's getting confused about that. I mean, everyone says his father is Abraham, but so let's see. Let's go on. So now let's talk a little bit about Miriam. Now that we actually know who she is, let's figure out who she is. Okay. So I have a source over here. This is from that journal that I referenced earlier, My Sentimental Self, diary by Lisa Aria, where she describes the school. She went to this school, right? So this is probably from the 1870s, right? We said that she lived until, the 1880s, okay? Right, so this date over here, right, is her date, okay? So what does it say? It says, our daily school where boys and girls were received, right? So interesting, so it was boys and girls in this school, right? It wasn't just a girls' school, was conducted by a Miss Belisario. Maybe it's her sister, I don't know, but presumably it's this Miriam, as we'll see. She's the one who's super educated. And under her guidance, many Jews, the Jessels, the Makadas, the Seabags, the Montefiores, right? So they're describing the elite of the Sephardic community, right? So that's what we saw in earlier sources. All present time magnates took with us their first lessons. Mess Belisario was a Jewess of the most rigid kind, a severe disciplinarian regarding the tradition of our faith as sacrosanct, and incidentally allotting to me a prize for reciting the Ten Commandments in Hebrew. I wish now that I could remember them to faithful observance even in English. Sad, sad. Her family was part of the new Reform congregation, but still sent their daughter to the school. So, right, the new Reform wasn't like, some of the people in that were very observant, they just did this breakaway synagogue. So she describes that her childhood, she was, you know, saying lots of prayers and things like that. So they were still going to the same schools together, even though one was Reform, right? Different than maybe Reform in America, which is more different. So here she goes, she quotes her, she goes, "Young ladies, don't laugh, but say the blessing," she would urge with uplifted hand when she entered the classroom, her brown wig well awry, to hear us tittering during a thunderstorm. She was a stern and stupendous figure and reported to have ridden to upbraid Charles Dickens for allotting the thief Fagin to the Jewish race. So sounds like she was a good, she had a personality. Yes. So okay, so that is our Miriam Mendez Belisario, a passionate advocate of it. Now, one of the things that are interesting is that I don't believe she ever married, right? So this wig is not a shadel, I don't think. Maybe she just wore a wig, I don't know. But it seems that it implies that all of the ladies we've been speaking about are either unmarried or childless, right? And I think that says something about society at that time, right? That is kind of the a role that women in that situation of life will often play, right? Where they will kind of devote themselves to the betterment of society, right? Those that are married with children are perhaps responsible first to their husbands, right, or to their children, and aren't necessarily as involved in those types of efforts. But those that aren't married or don't have children, right, they're devoting themselves to the children of the community, right, or to other affairs, and to the hospitals and to orphanages and things like that, right. And it seems that all of these publications are coming out of those kinds, ladies in those situations, which I think is interesting and probably accurate for kind of that time. Nowadays, our women can have it all, but at that point it seemed that there was almost like this one or the other, and as we saw, there were some who said that, you know, maybe Grace intentionally didn't get married, and we had seen that about Rebecca Gratz, that some people say that in Philadelphia, that she also intentionally didn't get married, that they realized that would split their attention if they did that and decided they wanted to focus on you know, education and stuff. Okay, so let's go on now. I would like to take a little bit of time now to actually look at her book, right? Because that's, I think, the part that'll be particularly interesting. Before we do that, any questions? So, Dave, what do you think? What do you think of my detective work?
Well, it's just an observation that the Jewish Encyclopedia is always wrong on Sephardic
But what's interesting is that if you just look in the archives of the synagogue that were published, I mean, it's very clear that there's been a mistake, but it's, I don't know what year that particular book was published, but they obviously didn't double check it when they did some of these later dictionaries, which were published in 2001 and so on, because they definitely precede that. So what's interesting in kind of doing this work, and I met today with our archivist, Miriam Rodriguez Pereira, she said, you always have to, and I've heard David say this, you know, you always have to double check these, and it takes a lot of work kind of figuring out exactly who is who, and names repeat, and you kind of have to be very careful and meticulous to source these genealogies and who's exactly related and how they're related. You can't just look in a book and say, this was this person's sibling, this person's cousin, because we just saw all these sources were wrong. And so you really need to kind of look at these things carefully, unfortunately.
But also, because I don't know about the Western Sephardi here, but there was also a well-established tradition among Western Sephardi in the Mediterranean that if there was a sibling with a lot of children and a sibling that was childless, some of the children would move to the child, would be raised by the childless sibling.
Maybe, I mean, but still the records still show who the actual birth parents are. They're still not checking that. So just take a look over here, because this is the opening page of the book. It says, Sabbath evenings at home, familiar conversations on the Jewish religion, its spirit and observances by Miriam Mendez Belisario, also author of Meir Ein B'nei HaNeurim, right, the one who gives light, enlightens the eyes of the children, in two parts, and this is going to be part one, right? So she has authored two books. It shows you what her previous publication was this dictionary, and now she's publishing Sabbath Evenings at Home. Okay, so let's take a look at a little bit what she writes over here, right? And this one is called, she writes over here, Chanoch Lenar al pi darko, gam ki yazkin lo yasur mimena, right? You should teach each child according to his way, and in that way, when they become elderly, they will not move away from it, right? So it's not one recipe for all, right? Each child has to be educated individually, right? That's from the Bible. Okay. So let's take a look. So before we go on, let me just talk about the way the book is structured. So the way the book is structured is it is a conversation between an aunt and her niece and nephew. We don't know the aunt's name, it's just aunt. The niece is Ruth, and the nephew is Jacob, which to me is, she inserted that for her deceased father, right? Her father's name was Jacob, and so she named one of the figures in the book Jacob. She doesn't name the other one, perhaps Yehudit, because her mother was still alive. I'm not sure how she chose the name Ruth, but she goes with Ruth and Jacob as her niece and nephew. And the story goes that the parents have been called away overseas. They leave their children with their aunt to look after the kids, and she develops with them this idea that every Friday evening they're going to talk about Judaism, right? And that every Friday evening she kind of prepares a subject that they're going to talk about, and it is a conversation, right? And so the book is written as kind of a series of paragraphs where Jacob says something, and the aunt says something, and then Ruth says something, and they kind of are having this conversation. It's very sweet. She always, Jacob, my love, Ruth, my dear girl, you know, like everything kind of starts with that kind of, like it's written in a way which is like, you almost like a picture, you know, like this very loving aunt sitting with the kids and talking to them, and sometimes she even reprimands them a little bit in it, talking about different subjects. It's broken into 24 conversations. Originally, I guess it sounds like it was two volumes. 24 conversations that talk about Judaism, talk about religion, go through Rambam's, Maimonides' 13 principles of faith, right? So there's lots of chapters on faith, and kind of go through a whole bunch of subjects relating to Judaism, theological things, and so on. It's a really good book. I would actually, after I've read 10 out of the 24, I would actually recommend people to read it today. I mean, the language can be a bit archaic, but I think it's actually really, it's really good. She writes in the intro that she based a lot of it off of the writings of Isaac Leeser, right, who's the rabbi in Philadelphia, who's also who's involved in many publications there. He's the editor of the main newspaper, Jewish newspaper in America at the time, and it seems that a lot of her learning comes from him. In fact, in one of the conversations, Jacob asks her. He goes, "Why was Abraham chosen?" Right? It's about the chapter is about the chosen people. He goes, "Why was Abraham chosen?" He goes, "It doesn't say in the Torah. It just all of a sudden says that God chose him." Now, if I were to ask around the room, probably most people would jump in and say, "Oh, it's because of the story. He recognized God first, and you know, he was thrown into the furnace and he survived." And she doesn't answer that. She answers, "We don't know. We don't know, right? And yet, like, the Torah is teaching us to have faith in God. That we know that God must have had a reason why he chose Abraham, and that's all we need to know, right? Because if God made the choice of Abraham, it must be that Abraham was worthy of it, right?" And what's clear is that she probably doesn't know this incredibly famous Rashi, right, who quotes the Midrash about what had happened, right? That she perhaps doesn't even have, in a sense, the ability to access that kind of information. Because it would be fair for her to say, "Well, this is what the Torah says. Oh, but there's also a rabbinic tradition." Like, I can understand that she wouldn't want to just present it as what the Bible says, but you would think she would throw in and say there's also this tradition. She doesn't even go there. So unless she's being really pedantic and saying, "I want the kids to only know what the Bible says and not know what rabbinic teachings are until they're adults," it seems that she perhaps just isn't familiar with that, right? So a lot of her knowledge is probably coming from other English works, right? So I don't know what her skill set in Hebrew is, though she does write this vocabulary, so you would think she does have some familiarity with Hebrew, and maybe she's just reading things that Isaac Leeser has published and so on, and she's kind of repackaged it you know, these all these things she's learned from reading his things from overseas as this dialogue. I don't know, something interesting kind of, I think, requires a little bit more care.
Would it also be complicated for a woman of her days to access the
source? No, absolutely. And we see Grace Aguilar, complains about that, right? In some of her writings, that she thinks, you know, because some people sometimes said that about Grace. They said, oh, you know, your stuff doesn't contain the rabbinic traditions. And she writes back, she says, well, you can't blame me for that because you don't teach me those things. So if you want me to know these things, then you also have to teach girls these things, right? So she's one of these early advocates of saying we should teach girls Talmud and so on. So you definitely, I don't know. So that's, I think, something interesting here. What's interesting about this is that historians have written about some of these other people we've spoken about. They haven't, at least that I can, they haven't written about this work. This work is essentially, there's once in a while I've seen some random books reference a thing here or there from it, but it actually hasn't been kind of looked at carefully by any academics. So it's been really fun kind of reading it, kind of without any other information about it, but except just what she writes. And it is full of, it's really good. I mean, it's incredibly substantive. I saw one person kind of writing about it refers to it as, like highbrow. And that, I think Hyamson says that. He goes, almost like that's why maybe it wasn't successful or whatever. You don't get the feeling that it's meant for kids. I mean, maybe that's who she wrote it for. I think it would be really good for adults. It'd be a good book for adults to read, or children, who are already a bit older to read. It requires thought. There's a lot of content in the work. Okay, so let's go on with a couple more things in it. So one of the things she does is she gives. You can see when she's writing these things, one of the questions is the kids ask, what's the deal with Christianity, Islam, Judaism? And she goes, let me give you an analogy. And she goes, there is the different train routes that exist. And she goes, how many major rail lines are there? And the kids say, there's the Northern Line, and there's the Eastern Line, and like one other line, which wasn't the Southern, like one other line. And she says, he goes, exactly, those are the, right? Imagine that was like maybe new to them at that time. Like there's train lines, right? This is in the 1850s. And they said, and she goes, and where do all of them converge? London, right? Everything's coming to London, but they're going off in different directions. And she says, and she goes to them, and she goes, now do you understand? And kind of like this pause, and she goes, this is the analogy of these different religions, right? That you have, what is in her analogy, what is London? God. London is God, right? And you have from these different lines that are going forth, right? But they're all stemming from God. They're all stemming from the Bible, right? And these lines are going off in different directions. You can mention sometimes you have split offs of those lines, right, as well, right? So you have different sects within these different communities, but that essentially they are different kind of lines. And it's really interesting kind of the way that she's seeing Christianity and Islam and Judaism as in their core, the way she sees it is that they are essentially the same. They have different rituals, they have some different beliefs, but at the end of the day, they're monotheistic, they're based on the Bible, right? They all converge on London, right, as it were. So I thought it was just great. I mean, it's just like a good timely parable that she was writing. One of the things that she also does, which is really interesting, she talks about the natural sciences. She talks about that, there's kind of revealed religion, and then she talks about kind of natural religion, right? And from that, she's drawing on this idea, right, that you can learn about religion from nature. And she talks about, about the different kind of things that happen in science and looking at the world and learning about nature, right? And that doesn't seem to be by accident either, right? Because this is the beginning of all of those types of study that are happening, right? You think about Darwin. You think about, the study of geology and things like that, right? Those are happening at her time. And she's really one of the only Jewish writers at this time who kind of focuses on this idea of, like, natural religion, right? Learning about God through nature, right? Almost what we might call, what do we call it today? Something design. Intelligent design, right? That she's essentially advocating this idea of intelligent design, right? That by looking at nature, you can see God, right? And so she's, you know, so while other Jewish writers are just saying we know about God because the Bible tells us about God, right? She's saying we also can see God through nature. So she's kind of one of the early people to start saying that we don't have to be scared of science, or we don't have to be scared of what we're discovering about nature, because all these discoveries simply enable us to see God even more, right, in another way. So that's kind of, I think, interesting that she's kind of ahead of the curve in that regard. Now, one of the things that she does, she tries to tackle some heavy issues, and one of the things that the children ask her about is, how do we know that the Torah is true? Right, so these are ideas that already are out there in the world, people denying the veracity of the Bible. And so here, in the third conversation, they go through the whole thing, and then there is a short kind of synopsis of it. So the evidence for the truth of the Torah that she plays out are the following grounds: continued existence of the Jewish nation, right? The fact that we survive as a people. The past and present history of the Israelites, bearing out literally the prophecy of Moses in Deuteronomy, right? Looking at the way that we've suffered, been punished, right? The fulfillment of the curses in Deuteronomy. Third, the present deserted and degraded state of Palestine, right? Which is another interesting, again, I think things that have now become more famous about kind of proofs of the Torah, right? But the fact that no other nation is able to successfully settle the Holy Land, right? That it is a land meant for the Jews, right? And so, obviously, at her time, it's pre the major development, and so she says it's still deserted. Fourth, the peculiar nature of some of the laws of the Pentateuch, precluding the possibility of human agency and direction. She says there are certain laws in the Torah that there is no way a man would have written those laws because they don't make any sense, right? Or in fact, they are dangerous. Like, for example, the fact that every so often you should let your land lie fallow and rely that there'll be a miracle that in the preceding year you'll have such an abundant crops that you will be able to survive the years of being fallow. Because no person would ever advocate that if it wasn't from God, because that would be, you know, suicide, right? So she kind of points to things in the Torah that indicate that it must come from God, because no person would write those laws. There's no, it's too dangerous to kind of just make up a law like that. Fifth, the duration and mutability of the laws of Pentateuch in contradiction to human legislation, right? The fact that the law has been maintained over millennia, right? She sees that as a proof of their authenticity and the originality of the law and the appeal of all religions to its dictates, right? The fact that the core principles of the Torah, right, have been adopted by all of these other religions, right? That also indicates the truth of the Torah, right? And so this is really interesting, kind of one of these early texts that really kind of addressing why should we believe. And you kind of think of those books nowadays, you know, coming out about, you know, basic Judaism, trying to prove God and things like that. She's doing this in the 1850s. So I think that's, I think it's really cool. And I really enjoyed reading them. I thought it was really nice. And like I said, I would really encourage people to read this book. One of the things that she also gets involved with is not only belief in the Torah, but they should believe in the oral law, right? How do we know that the oral tradition was also given to Moses at Sinai? And so she addresses those questions. So she's really going into these questions where you see the effects of either just secularism or this new reform movement, right? Where they are maybe denying the obligation to keep certain laws anymore, right? And she's trying to show that no, that's not true. They're wrong. You have to keep the mitzvot. You have to follow the traditions of the rabbins as well, right? You can't say, I'm going to only follow the Bible says, not what the rabbi says. No, she says it all ultimately comes from God. And so she's addressing the challenges of secularism, or what we call reform, right? Or kind of these changes, right, in beliefs within parts of the Jewish community. She's addressing them head on. In fact, one of the things that Jacob asks her is, you know, why are we praying in Hebrew? Shouldn't we pray in English so that we can understand our prayers, right? And clearly that's an argument of reform, right? That she's putting into the child's mouth, right? And she's responding to it and saying that no, you know, Hebrew is what we've been prayed in. It's our language. It's our nation's language. She goes, especially in places like London, where we have Jews come from all over the world. If we prayed in English, then Jews that came from new places would feel alienated in synagogue or praying in Hebrew. It means that Jews from all over the world can pray together, right? And that this is, you know, really important that we maintain our prayers. She goes, that's why it's important that we have to teach kids Hebrew from a young age so that they can read it and they can understand it and not feel that challenge of the fact that it's not in language that they can understand. But again, she's clearly responding to what's happening in the Jewish community at that time. Now, one of the things that's nice that she talks about, let me see if I have it here, is the idea about talents. Let me see. Yeah. Wait, so no, this is not it right here. Let me see if I have it in my other thing here. I've been reading this on different devices. Yeah. So the child is asking about, you know, in a sense, how, you know, how we serve God, and, you know, that some people have talents, some people don't have talents, you know, so what are you supposed to do? So she goes to the father, she goes, my dear boy, as I said before, God does not judge like mortals. He will not require of us more than he has given. But I see you have fallen into the common error of applying the word talent only to the power of acquiring deep learning. As, of course, every child thinks the only talent is to become a scholar, right? Consequently, you think that to write and publish books is the only way for talent to work good to mankind, right? Somehow being a reference to what she has done is the greatest talent, right? While certainly to those so gifted, it is part of their line of duty to open the gates of wisdom to their less fortunate brethren, to glorify their creator by displaying the wonders of his creation in their writings. But above all, ought they to consider it their portion to use the power granted them in teaching the knowledge and fear of God, the beauties and requirements of religion, and the peculiar privileges and blessings of their own faith, as far as they themselves understand them and their ability will extend. Right? Thus, then, indeed, if their efforts have aided in the slightest degree in enlightening ignorance, if the inspired eloquence of their pen have assisted in rousing the indolent and indifferent from their mental apathy, and so, in recalling their dormant religious feelings, have induced them to renew their service to their God, then truly may we deem such talent blessed. But then she says, but don't worry, even people that don't have it, right, they teach through example, right? By living a good Jewish life, right, that is how we can have talents to influence other people as well. So don't worry if you're not a scholar. Don't worry if you don't have the ability to write, like some people do, right? You can contribute through being a good Jew, right? And by influencing and being a positive example on others. And she goes on, she goes, if you have money and supporting things, right? She quotes other ways you do, but kind of like this, she's talking about herself, right? So it's really interesting kind of seeing those almost autobiographical parts in her book that are obviously kind of her reflection about herself, right? And she has a line over here where she says, and this doesn't only apply to boys, right? She goes, there is not one of God's children, but has some talent or gift confided in him or her, in italics. For women, my dear Ruth, are equally accountable with men for the use of the gifts bestowed on them. Indeed, their responsibilities are far more important than I fear we are aware of. Okay, and right, so she's obviously saying that women also have to find a way to contribute and to use their talents for the service of God. That's not only the realm of men. Okay, so let's just look at one other thing here where we'll kind of conclude with this, where she talks about what she thinks kind of the value of women is. So Ruth asks, it goes, why, aunt? This exactly applies to what you were telling me the other day of the value and influence of a virtuous woman. How I pray that I may grow up to answer to this description in its general meaning. Aunt, if you will resolve earnestly and sincerely to conquer your chief fault, vanity, I have every hope, my love, that you will be assisted in your efforts, and that in time we shall have the pleasure of seeing you all we can desire. But in order to accomplish this, you must make up your mind steadily to face the truth, to recognize that the possession of mere beauty reflects no merit upon you. It is undoubtedly true that you have a pleasing exterior with pretty, regular features, and may become in the lapse of years what the world terms handsome. But I see not how you can arrogate any praise to yourself on that score. Beauty is not a virtue or a talent that you have taken pains to cultivate. It is a gift from the Almighty, which may at any moment be withdrawn. Witness the dire effects of smallpox. And at the best, it is but a transitory possession to which time is a ruthless foe. Therefore, my dear child, let us pray to be strengthened to resist the temptation of setting store by such a fleeting, frivolous advantage. Let us rather seek to lay up treasures of virtue and piety, which, if carefully guarded, will remain with us till the last hour of our existence, retaining the same impressionable luster. Now, my boy, repeat the eighth commandment. Okay, so it's a beautiful kind of focus on the true value of a person, and perhaps again trying to respond to some of the trends she sees in her age. So, like I said, I didn't make it through the entire work yet, but it's full of lots of treasures like this, and I think everyone would enjoy it. She comes from an interesting family of intrigue and international intrigue and so on, and produced a beautiful work. So I think she certainly produced something that which we became proud of, perhaps because of its, I don't know, maybe it's the amount of things in it. It made it difficult for it to become a major success. What's interesting is you can see the people who were buying it in the beginning of the work. It says kind of the subscribers to it, and you can see kind of how many copies everyone got. So, you know, in it you can see that Lady Montefiore bought 10, Sir Moses bought 50, right? So those were probably for the synagogue school, maybe the hospital, the Jews' hospital, that those would have been for. But the Aguilar family bought 6, so maybe that was for their school that they would have been getting that for. St. Thomas ordered 25 copies, so the Spanish Portuguese community there had ordered some. There was a Spanish Portuguese community. There's still a synagogue there. And so, whatever, you can kind of see who was, purchasing these things and who was making use of them. So, perhaps we can give it a second life in our day. Yes?
Remembers, did she only teach Sephardi children exclusively, or did she also teach Ashkenazi children?
I only know what we saw. I only know what we saw. So, those names that we saw before of the families are the ones we know about. So, it seems that there, at least the ones we know about, were Sephardic. Whether that means it was only Sephardic, I don't know. What is in here, she talks about the Shema, and she writes the Shema, S-H-E-M-A-N-G, Shemang, which is the old Spanish-Portuguese way of pronouncing it. So she definitely is writing this for the Spanish-Portuguese audience. Yeah. In that case, thank you all so much for coming. Next session will be at the beginning of February, and we will be looking at Charlotte Montefiore, one of the lesser known Montefiores, but a really important figure. So I look forward to seeing all of you then, and have a good night.
One interesting thing would be to figure out where the school was, because in Hackney, there is an existing high school that used to be a Jewish girl.